Accession number 27767, Reel 7.
Adrian Holloway, Reel 7.
Furthermore, when we were in action with these French destroyers, they also used a chemical dye to spot their fall of shot. And so this would produce a green splash. And there was one of their shells came so close to us that one of our officers on the bridge sported a green beard for about a week. It was a very inconclusive action. I don't think we did much damage to them, and they didn't do much to us. And there was also a French submarine which was lurking around, and we know that it fired a torpedo at us. They were based in Beirut, which was declared an open city, which meant, of course, that we couldn't attack it, and it was illuminated at night. And they presumably had a minefield through which they could escape and got back into Beirut. Well, then our other time in this small action, small war, was to patrol up and down the Syrian coast, bombarding positions which the army had asked us to fire at. And the first time we did this, six fighter planes appeared, and having been through Crete, we were extremely trigger happy, and the gunners laid their guns on the target and nearly opened fire. And then a great cheer went up because the aircraft were waggling their wings, and it was actually the RAF who'd come to protect us. And I learned later on that one of the pilots was Roald Dahl. So that was very nice, and if anything can be said to be switch it off for a moment, can you? Trying to think of the word. Can be said about the Syrian war, it was certainly not as dangerous as Crete, and we had more support from our own forces, which in itself was a small relaxation for us. The French did fire at us from the shore, but we were able to get out of range and then pop back in again and fire at them. For some extraordinary gentlemanly reason, everybody seemed to stop firing at tea time. But you see... in the end... The French surrendered, and we made them clear up all the mines that they had laid, because we didn't see why we should undertake a dangerous job like that. And what is more, General Dentz, the French commander, was told that if he didn't release the prisoners who had been taken, and they were by that time in Vichy France and were destined for Germany, if they were not returned to us, then he would be very severely punished himself. And so that concentrated his mind, and we got the prisoners back. So all in all, it was an interesting war and a very sad one in that we had to fight our French allies.
So you were still with the Australians?
Yes.
Did that go on much longer?
Yes, well, we were, at the end of the Syrian war, we were told that there was a French warship which was still proving troublesome off port side, and then we were asked to look for her. But then the order was countermanded, and we found ourselves on our way back to Alexandria. But what was quite a frightening thing was that we came upon the whole of the British Mediterranean fleet on an exercise as we made our way back to Alexandria. And this was at night, and suddenly we were illuminated by the battleship searchlights. And that was really a very frightening thing. We presumed and hoped that they were friendly, but we didn't know.
Where were you at this moment?
I was on the upper deck. You felt so naked. Absolutely. You know, the place was, I think, was light as day. But anyway, recognition signals were made, and that was all right, and we got back to Alexandria. So it was when we got back to Alexandria, my time was up, and never have I been more thankful to leave a ship.
You never bonded with the Australians?
No, I did not.
All that you've been through together?
Well, you, as I explained, you see, you really didn't have the time. It was... You snatched a meal when you could have it. I certainly never went ashore with them or anything. There wasn't anybody of my rank to do it. There was a Royal Naval Reserve, Royal Australian Naval Reserve midshipman, who joined subsequently, but I took a dislike to him, and I don't think he liked me very much, so we didn't do anything either. I must just put his leg down. I'll put it down for the moment. So that was that, and I've never been, as I say, more pleased to leave a ship. I practically whirled my cap round my head as I was left.
Did you know where you were going on to?
Yes, I knew I was due to go back to Valiant. And I remember going up the lovely gangway of Valiant and feeling that I'd come home, and the officer of the watch said, "Oh, Holloway, been away long? You're on the first watch to this evening." So that was that, but I was very glad to be back. And the extraordinary thing is that all my clothes and everything else were in a trunk and so on, and it was all saved, and I didn't lose anything. Really, I was very lucky in that respect.
What had Valiant been doing while you were away?
She, Valiant, together with her sister ship Warspite, had both taken part in the Cretan campaign. But in my opinion, my humble opinion, it was quite crazy, because they both got bombed. Warspite so badly that she had to go back to, she had to leave the Mediterranean altogether. I'm so sorry. And was repaired in the States. Valence had a near miss, and she went into the floating dock and had that repaired. But Crete was not the place for a major warship. It was a small warship war, and even the cruisers, you see, had a most dreadful time. So to risk the battle fleet there, of which there were only three battleships, was taking a risk which shouldn't have been taken.
So your crew on Valiant had some tales to tell about Crete, and were they interested in what you'd been doing?
No, they weren't. Nobody sort of talked about it at all, really. It was a funny sort of thing. You know, then again, it was very difficult, because even if it's in the harbour, you were watch on, watch off. If you were in the harbour, you were manning the anti-aircraft guns and so on. And watches had to be kept. Then we got all our technical work to do, taking sights and heaven knows what else, and working these things out, writing up journals. And life was not a bowl of cherries. You didn't have time for social chit-chat very much.
Sorry, can imagine.
No, not a bit.
Yeah.
Life then was really rather nice, and it was almost peacetime. Not that I'd known the Navy in peacetime, but we had a carnival on board, and everybody dressed up in fancy dress.
Was that an aid of what?
Why just to amuse the troops, as it were. And that was very good fun, and everybody laughed to see the various officers dressed up. And then there was There was rugger being played and a regatta, a pulling regatta, rowing regatta. And so that was done too. And that was rather a ridiculous thing because the appointment of one of our midshipmen, Greenlees, who'd been with me at Dartmouth, was cancelled when he was going to a destroyer simply because he was the best member of the rowing crew, which I thought was rather a ridiculous thing to do in wartime.
And this was while you were in Alexandria?
Yes, this is while we were in Alexandria, yeah. But Alexandria was a nice place to be if you were going to be anywhere. It was an international seaport of very ancient origin, and there were cinemas to go to. I think I've been through all this, actually. It was nice to go ashore and get some relaxation there.
So this is getting towards autumn.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, came November 1941, and we were ordered to steam eastward, the whole battle fleet, to create a diversion for some ships that were being brought through the Sicilian Narrows once more. And that was fairly uneventful until the afternoon of November the 26th. I was down in this high-angle control position. I was back there again for my action station. In spite of it being November, it was a warm afternoon. I'd got my headphones on, connecting me to the director tower up top where my friend Parker was. The Royal Marine bandsmen actually were manning this particular position that afternoon. And I was sitting with my back to the bulkhead and not thinking of anything very much. And suddenly Parker shouted down the phones, start up the table. That was the table that you had to, an electrical table, which computed all the range and bearing for the guns. He said, Barham, that's our third battleship, has been torpedoed. And I relayed this to the Royal Marines, who looked as I did, completely ashen. And then Parker was relaying all this from the control tower. And he said, she's heeling over. There's steam and smoke coming out of her funnels. I can see men running down the side of the ship and jumping into the water. And then he said, oh, my God, she's blown up. And we could hear down below even the frightful bang. She was only 200 yards ahead of us. What had happened was that water had got into her funnels. And therefore, of course, that had created an explosion in the boiler rooms. And she blew up with a loss of 800 men. I remember exactly what I did just before she blew up. I looked at the bulkhead and I thought, my God, if there's another submarine there, the torpedoes will come through there, which of course was quite ridiculous because I wouldn't have known anything about it, but it was the thing that I thought at the time. And of course we didn't stop. We put on full speed. Battleships don't stop to pick up survivors. That's left to the destroyers. But what was incredible was that this submarine, which was German, because it had fired four torpedoes at Barham, all of which had hit, she lost buoyancy and she came up alongside us and scraped our side. And what was so frustrating was that the ratings tried to fire at her, but none of the guns would depress as low as that. They weren't made for that. They were meant to be up and high and shooting horizontally. And so some of them literally shook their fists that there we were, a huge fighting steel sea castle, and there was nothing we could do whatsoever. So she scraped along our side and eventually went down again, and we knew nothing more. But it really was the most frightful and frightening time. And there, as I think I've shown you, there is the photograph.
And that must have had a huge effect on your...
Well, it did, because we didn't know if there wasn't a pack around. They'd hunted in packs in the Atlantic. They didn't do so in the Mediterranean because they couldn't get an awful lot of submarines into the Med because they had to pass through Gibraltar, and that was difficult for them. It was a frightening thing. Well, then there was a slightly amusing thing about it, that the commander-in-chief decided that he wouldn't break radio silence, but he had to report the loss of Barham. So he flew off one of the aircraft with a written message about it all, and this was meant to be frightfully secret. Well, the pilot got back to Alexandria and duly delivered the message, and he went in just before lunch to the Cecil Hotel in Alexandria, and the only thing that was being talked about at the bar was the loss of Barham. So people had got onto that very quickly. And then when we got back to Alexandria, some bright spark had put us into the berth normally occupied by Barham, which we didn't think was a very funny thing to do. But that really was awful. Shall I relate what happened to some of the survivors? Mm-hmm. About a month or so later, we got some of the midshipmen who were survivors from Barham. And one would have been a particular friend of mine called Peter Edwards, who had been with me in my term at Dartmouth. He said what happened was that he was sitting in the gun room reading a paper, and suddenly all the lights went out. There was a frightful lot of smoke, and water began coming into the gun room. He guessed what had happened and rushed out onto the upper deck. And he could see the ship by that time was heeling at about 15 or 20 degrees, and there was nothing for it but to try and get into the water. Now, that wasn't as simple as you might think, because he kicked off his shoes, and the ship's bottom, like all of them, were covered with barnacles. Now, they're very abrasive, so if you slid down it, you would take all the skin off your body. If you jumped, you might hit the part that was still submerged and break your legs. And so he did jump, and fortunately he was all right. And he went down and down and down and down until he thought he could never would draw another breath. And then he opened his mouth and he breathed air. He was in an enormous air bubble, which ships do create when they go down for some reason. I don't know how it's caused, but that saved his life and a lot of others. And he came up. And then, of course, he was wearing one of the ridiculous naval life belts. This was a... Shall I go on? And
yes, do.
A thing that you hung round your neck and you tied it behind you. There was a rubber tube there, and you were meant to blow up the life belt when you were in the water. You were always told never to blow it up before, because it would probably explode if you hit the water with it. Well, now, he had to imagine, he was confronted with a situation that he came up from the air bubble, and then, of course, the water was absolutely full of oil fuel, which was viscose, and if you swallowed it, you would probably choke. Added to that, he was supposed to blow up this ridiculous lifeboat, which was, of course, was impossible. So he found a chair which was floating and clung on to that, and then they were able to find a Carly raft and they were picked up by a destroyer. But later on, I think those lifebelts were altered, but they were the most useless things ever.
Did you, as a sailor, ever plan or think about how you would get away from your ship if it was sinking?
Indeed, yes, I did, because it varied, of course, as to where you were. Now, the thing was this, what should you wear? Well, you weren't wearing much in the heat, and the general opinion was that you should kick off your shoes, because they would weigh you down, and go in shirt and shorts, which you'd be wearing anyway. So that was probably the best thing. Fortunately, I never had to do this in the Atlantic or anything like that. But what you did when you got ashore, and of course you hadn't got any shoes, I don't know, but I suppose you'd be fortunate to reach land at all. So that's
something
what we
you did think about.
Oh, yes, I did. Yeah. Most certainly. And we queried, questioned those who had had to swim for it. And that was an amusing thing in a sense, because later on, Admiral Tennant, who'd been torpedoed in Prince of Wales, he was made Admiral. When he was inspecting anybody, he would say, "Have you had to swim for it?" He was very proud of the fact he'd had to and survived. So that was that, and the Mediterranean fleet was depleted and now down to two battleships. Can I just have a little water, please? It's behind you. It may be of interest that Barham was the only British battleship to be sunk by a submarine during the entire war. Royal Oak had been sunk by in harbour in Scarpa Flow, and Prince of Wales and Repulse were both sunk by aircraft. So that may be an unenviable distinction.
Where were you when the Prince of Wales and Repulse went down?
Well, I'll come to that.
Right, yeah.
Okay. On December the 10th, 1941, I had been ashore to see a film. It was a rather cold for Alexandria evening, and it was spotting with rain and not very pleasant at all. And I came on board to the quarter deck, and I was greeted by the officer of the watch, who was a friend of mine, a sub-lieutenant Begley, who before the war had been a draftsman with Camel Laird. And he said to me in a shocked voice, "Prince of Wales and Repulse have been sunk." And I could not believe this. I mean, there were two of our most famous capital ships. And the world, of course, knows what happened to them, that they were taken out from Singapore with no air cover. And the Japanese used them for target practice. But it brought home to us how vulnerable we were and made everybody think very, 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 very much.
Because in a way the senior officers must have had it as part of their sort of aim to make people not feel so vulnerable, really.
I think that's true. You see,
security.
Yeah. You see, pre-war and pre-First World War and so on, the god was gunnery. Anybody who wanted to get promotion became a gunnery officer. And in fact, a lot of them became rather ferocious chaps, and there was one story that a chap said, "Everybody becomes a gunnery officer so that he won't have to serve with another gunnery officer, because there's only one to a ship." that was the thing, and nobody had envisaged, I think, how great would be the power of aircraft against ships at sea. I think the Americans had a far better anti-aircraft guns and fire control than we did. And ours just wouldn't stand up to it. I only remember once during Crete we did shoot down an enemy aircraft. But it was the exception very much so rather than the rule. And that is why everybody's attitude was so entirely different. If there's a certain little story which might envisage this, show it to you. Before the war, Cunningham, who was the captain of the ship, had a sub-lieutenant called Winnie. And Winnie applied, as he had to his captain, to become a pilot in the Fleet Air Arm. Action was swift. Order came through for Winnie to report to the captain's cabin in full dress uniform, cocked hat, frock coat and sword. And when he got there, Cunning was standing with his letter in his hand and almost shaking with fury said, "What is this?" And Winnie said, "My application to become a pilot, sir." So Cunningham said, "What did you join the Navy for?" "To go to sea, sir." Cunningham nodded curtly, tore up the application and dismissed him. That was the attitude of senior officers at the time. Yeah. The only officer who got to flag rank, became an admiral, was Caspar John, the son of the artist Augustus. And he became the first one with wings. And so he started a trend. But it was all against the Fleet Air Arm. I think they were either. I think the gunnery officers were jealous that their kingdom was being taken over. Hope that's not too irrelevant.
No. It's an interesting sidelight, yes.
Well, it is, you see. I don't say that was confined to our navy. To a certain degree, although it sounds funny, the Japs were the same. They continued to build capital ships, but they did increase their aircraft carriers and so on. Now, if you'd like to just switch that off a sec. I now come to what has been described in a recent history of the naval war in the Mediterranean as arguably the single greatest feat of arms on either side throughout the entire Second World War. That's strong stuff, but it may well be true. What happened was that employing six men, the Italians crippled the remaining two battleships of the British fleet in Alexandria, and thus altered the balance of sea power in that area in the Italians' favour for 6 months. That was such an economy of effort when you consider that the Battle of Matapan, which we won, we destroyed three of their cruisers, but it took us, we used three battleships, eight cruisers, an aircraft carrier and 10 destroyers. And for sheer economy of effort, the Italian attack on Alexandria that night takes a lot of beating. What happened was that, extraordinarily enough, we had a good lot of warning about all this. In August, I and other midshipmen, even lowly ranks such as that, had been ordered to attend a conference at Rasselton, which was the naval headquarters. And there were also Egyptian army and naval officers, such as there were, in immaculate uniforms and red fezzes, and they were all corralled in one part of the room and we were in another. And the captain of Rasselton outlined to us the fact that it was known that the Italians were using midget submarines to attack shipping, And in fact, they had already sunk the cruiser York in Suda Bay before the Battle of Crete, and she'd been so badly damaged she had to be beached and left to the tender mercies of the Germans when they took the place over. So that we knew that these things were in being,